You know, have you had the feeling that we've taken up space as a gigantic hobby? I mean, all of mankind. I'm not talking about just America. I mean, it's all of mankind has taken up orbiting and whirling and shooting guys to Jupiter as a kind of hobby, you know? And it's a very expensive one. But nevertheless, a hobby is really no fun unless it is expensive. I mean, you know, that's the fallacy with collecting matchbook covers, Al. You collect, you know, 8,000 matchbook covers. It's up to your knees. And what is, you know, you got gunny sacks full of them in the basement. You got your house plastered with them. And what do you got? A hobby doesn't count unless you have to pay through the nose for it. No, seriously. And, you gotta lay it right out. I gave up marbles. You know, it became too easy. You make 400 marbles for a dollar. You know what? You know, this is no good. I've tried all kinds of hobbies. As a matter of fact, I know one guy. One guy took up chicks as a hobby, and it was okay. This is a friend of mine. It was okay for a while, and he never really appreciated it until he found himself faced with two lawsuits, and he had a $4,000 bill from a doctor for gunshot wounds. Then he began to appreciate what he was up to. Then it began, and ever since that time, he's been insane, out of his skull. You know, it's the truth. There's a lot of reality to this. You can't push it aside. Now, one way or the other. Now, speaking of hobbies, you know, I was reminded that we've had a request from a couple of people to tell more about Millard. Now, why did I? You know, remember Millard, the great surveyor? Did I tell you about the time that I did the awful thing? It's all connected with the hobbies, you know? And since we've brought up the subject of hobbies, one of the greatest hobby stories, and we certainly like to see young people have interesting, involving hobbies these days, and one of the greatest hobby stories I've seen in a long time is a little story that opened the other day, came in the New York Post. Yes. Today's salute to today's hobbyist. Outside the white frame house in Huntington, Long Island, there is a big yard filled with trees. And when it's over, old man, set her back and just keep playing it over and over. No, don't keep picking it down. Outside the white frame house in Huntington, Long Island, there is a big yard filled with trees. A football lies forgotten on the lawn, and parked nearby, waiting for summer, is a small motorboat. It is a tranquil scene, but today a neighbor nodded toward the home, and the home and the neighbor said, both are deceptive. Something is seriously wrong in that house, he said. Suffolk County police agree. Inside the house, police say they have found a 10-foot-wide swastika, a submachine gun, a complete Nazi uniform, pictures of American Nazi Party leader George Lincoln Rockwell, and stacks of party pamphlets and sticks. Just set it back and let it go. No, not the next cut. That's all right. Now, see, you threw me all off. Oh, boy. Forget the music, okay? It's getting too confusing in there with the music. No, better put some music on. Just play anything. No, not that one. No, the other record. And just play anything and let it go. And just let it play behind me. Any cut. Just get any cut. There you go. Just let it play behind me now. You don't mess with the controls, okay? Suffolk County police agree. Inside the house, police say they have found a 10-foot-wide swastika, a submachine gun, a complete Nazi uniform, pictures of American Nazi Party leader George Lincoln Rockwell, and stacks of party pamphlets and stickers. The young lad, 17 years old, who owned the room where all these trinkets were found, faces court action tomorrow with several of his teenage pals, all charged with using the submachine gun to spray bullets last Friday night through the front door of a Huntington High School English teacher's home and through the office windows of the school principal. Calling the lad the group's leader, police said the youth had become a Rockwell admirer last summer on a weekend trip to the neo-Nazis camp in Arlington, Virginia. You know these kids and their hobbies, said the father. I tried to tell them to pick up something else, but this was kind of repulsive, but you know those kids and their hobbies. Yes, youth of America. We salute hobbyists everywhere. And tonight, we salute tonight's most effective, and certainly we salute tonight's most creative hobbyist. A a young 17-year-old boy out in Long Island who is following in the footsteps of Tom Swift with his electric rifle and other great hobbyists of the past. Come on, just bring it up. Wow, boy, I'm getting seasick. Take it all out. What are you? Oi. Take it out. Out, huh? Well, I just thought you ought to know that there are all kinds of hobbies. I thought that was the great quote of the year. These young kids and their hobbies. Well, you know, hobby, the whole world of the hobby and and what we're doing with it, I do believe, and I'm very serious about this. I'm sitting there, and all this space stuff is going on today, and it's highly intriguing and fascinating and all. I admit this. And I'm listening, and it's exciting, and wow. A strange thing happened to me today in connection with the gigantic mankind hobby of getting sent to Jupiter or wherever it is that we're trying to take I guess it would be an eternity-long weekend. Yes, all hobbies have to do with escape. You know that, don't you? That, yes, that's the whole essence of a hobby, is to get away from that which has enveloped you. And so a man who is deeply involved in abstract considerations of theoretical problems all day long finds himself as a hobbyist rowing a birch bark canoe in Maine, digging worms. Well, now this is a diametrically opposed, you see, to what he does all day long. Well, now, most of us, as you know, are earthbound. I mean, we slog along and we have trouble with our feet. And we fool around, and we argue with insurance men, and we get tickets on motor scooters and all that kind of jazz. Can you imagine any more exciting, thrilling hobby than all of mankind to be projected to Pluto? Getting away from it all of it, the whole rotten mess? Boy. And in fact, one radio station the other day, knowing and realizing this, Al, realizing that this is really the basic of all this business of space, went all the way. I heard them. It wasn't WOR. It says, yes, you see, they realize that people who listen to records and all that, in a sense, are vicariously involved in these sad love affairs of these nasal 12-year-olders who sing these records into the echo chambers. And one thing about news is it has a tendency to cut you out. Now, you know, I mean, it really does. I mean, if say, for example, some guy sits on a flagpole somewhere in Cleveland for 37 days and it's reported on the news, you feel kind of let out, in a way, if he isn't doing it for you or somehow involves you or all of you. It has to be done. It has to be brought in. So I heard the announcement on the radio station that says, yes, you can participate in tomorrow's gigantic orbital shoot. You can participate, and you must be prepared. So we are going to have a special briefing for you. There's more double talk with this space thing. One of the great double talk words that I heard today, I just caught this one going away. I was standing here. I wonder how many people sat in front of a television set for 47 hours just looking at a picture of a carrier. Nothing else on it, just a picture, just this picture of this carrier. Did you see that? You didn't. Well, then you don't know what I'm talking about. That there was just a picture there, see. But somehow looking at the television set gives you an idea that you're getting more than listening to it on the radio, even if it's just a plain picture of a carrier. It's not the same carrier. It was photographed 6 years ago. Has nothing to do with the space. Just a picture there. And everybody sort of feels that comforting thing. But nevertheless, one of the great words that I heard in connection with this space thing was the word today, they are going to unbrief Colonel or Major Cooper. They're going to unbrief him. Now, how do you get unbriefed? Now, that is a very difficult problem, to unbrief a man. Do you know quite what that means, though? You're a newsman. Well, you use it on your newscast. What do you mean you don't know? You wrote it up. They were going to unbrief him, you see. Like briefing is something you put on like a hat, you know. You put it on, and then when you're done, you take it off. You know, you unbrief the guy. You're unbriefed now, Fred. Like you unbutton your sleepers before you go to bed. Or button them, is that what you do? You know? Well, it was very, very interesting afternoon, and I must say it was very exciting, and it involves everybody. That's one thing you've got to admit. A hobby has to involve you. It's otherwise, forget it. It's no hobby. Now, a hobby has to involve you in a lot of ways. One, there has to be an element of danger to it. Oh, yes, all good hobbies have an element of danger. Yes, they do. Real hobbies. Even if it's a peripheral, like skiing, don't you think? If skiing, believe me, if you went down, if they let you ski and you could hold on to two railings built on the side of a mountain with handles, and the skis were on rollers, and you were on the same snow, you wouldn't even go near it. That's a fact. And as our world gets more complicated and more technical involved with the technicalities of existence, the more our hobbies have to be dangerous, or else they don't mean much, you know, they really don't. So guys today have taken up parachute jumping. Are you aware that one of the new big hobbies is guys jumping in parachutes? I mean, this is called sport parachuting. A parachute used to be for saving guys' necks. Now it's for just jumping out. And getting into cigarette commercials, you know that. Oh, yeah, women are doing it. Oh, sure, the whole business. As a matter of fact, I suspect that one of the new Olympic events, Al, could very well be in the next couple of years spot hand grenade throwing. I mean, I think that would make a very good... There's the overhand grenade throw, there's the sidearm grenade throw, and then they have what they call the freestyle, which is a very exciting event. And then there will, even more important than that, there will be hand grenade ducking, which is a very exciting event. And it's, you know, you wear the special uniform with the helmet and all that. That's an exciting... Oh, speaking of hand grenade ducking, did I tell you about the great letter I got? Oh, I'll save that for tomorrow. Remind me, make a note, great letter. Has to do with hand grenade ducking as a hobby. But it has to involve everybody, and I did not realize the full extent of how successful this new hobby is, I mean, on a worldwide basis. It really does. It involves everybody. I'm talking about mankind. And believe me, don't think for a minute I'm being un-American here by saying I enjoyed it more than anybody else. What is it, consensus of opinion on being un-American? Is that it? No. Oh, they want to know what the theme was yesterday afternoon on the Martha Dean show? Well, such hang-ups. Well, I'm walking down the street today, and I got this little transistor radio, you see. I'll tell you the exact incident that happened. It's a great moment. I bet Cooper would like to know this. I'm walking down the street, and I'm in a rotten neighborhood. And I got this transistor, and I'm listening, and the astronaut has just landed in the water. And you can hear the report, 8,000 phantom computer yards off the bar, and now they switch through to Project Mercury, and they control there. My transistor added to the fact that they were using single sideband transmission, added to the fact that there were obviously a few little, there were a few heterodynes coming in and out of that. It made a very, very wonderful... I thought I was listening to a rock and roll station that had an LP on, you know. It just went out. And I'm listening with one ear on the transistor and the other, you know, I'm watching the traffic and all. And suddenly I feel a tugging at my elbow. It's a bum. Well, I figured this is, you see, usually I'm on the alert for that. But I was caught trapped, you know. I had the transistor. I didn't know. No, this bum came up and he was solid stubble all the way down to his feet. You know, the kind of gray sort of, you know the kind of a gray sort of, and he's got a gray shirt all torn open. He comes reeling on. He's got a hold of me by the elbow, and trapped. I was trapped by a light, red. And there were a lot of cars going. I couldn't, and my radio's going, the astronauts, the helicopter number one, they're rolling, helicopter number one, and third elevator. And they're going on like that, you know, and I'm listening. And what do you think the bum said? He comes up to me and he's, hey, say, buddy, did he get down all right? I said, what? Did he get down all right? It's okay, everything all right? And he staggered around there, hanging on to me. And he's talking about the astronaut. He says, did he get down okay? Do I have to translate it for you, or didn't you understand what he said? Oh, you didn't understand it, I say. Did he get down all right? And I said, yes, he did. He got down okay. Very exciting. And I take my transistor radio and I turn it up, and he's listening, and it's going. And water Cronkite comes on. And he's standing there. He can't understand any more than I can understand. We're both standing there with our ears on each side of the LP on that thing that's playing, see? It sounded like a gigantic, scratchy LP, and both of us are standing in the traffic, and about four other guys came up. And it's... and the bum is staggering around. He even forgot to nick me for a dime. He had me cold turkey. That's how excited he was. Speaking of, oh, it's funny when I remind it. This is WOR AM and FM New York. Funny how stubble and all that reminds you. But this is the real involvement. You know, a hobby. Hobby gets you. Oh, let's get on with the commercials here. The next thing we have here, speaking of hobbies, is the limelight. Now, hanging around coffee joints is a hobby, with not only a hobby, but it's a way of life with many people. And I was debating tonight to tell. I didn't know whether I ought to tell the story about this hobby thing. Debating about it here. I think, you know, speaking of hobbies, I for years have been, among other things, I've been involved. One of my hobbies is baseball. I must admit this. Now, immediately everybody turns to me and says, oh, baseball, Sty. Well, I'm going to tell you, I wonder if any of you were there. You know, it's funny. Once in a great while, some guy will call up and he will have seen the same scene that I was involved in, or will have been at the same place at the same time, and there is a great moment of communion. You know what I mean? Well, I've been going to ball games, and now, lady, if you're turning away, this is not a story. That comes later, Ted. It'll come later. It's okay. Now, this is not a story about a ball game. It is a story about something much more peculiar than that. I was in the Army, and there were a lot of other guys in the Army. And for one brief period in my Army career, I was stationed at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, which is not very far from here. Now, I tell you, I have a theory that many guys entered the Army out of the Midwest and out of the South as innocently as newborn babes, absolutely innocently. And the guys from the East Coast entered the Army, generally speaking, with a very different attitude. The East Coast is a real make-it world, particularly the New Yorkers. These are real make-it guys. Hardly any guy over the age of 16 and 17 in this town isn't already on the make. He's already making the scene in one way or another, in such a way that a guy who was 16 or 17, let's say, in Cleveland, couldn't possibly understand it. It's an interesting difference. I've watched high school kids come out of high schools. They've got high schools in this town. For example, there's a high school in this town that is nothing but about advertising. Yes, sir, there is a high school of advertising and art here in New York City, which would be incomprehensible to people living, say, in Indianapolis. Advertising is something that happens to people out there. It isn't something you do, you know. They've got high schools of showbiz here in town. They got high schools on kids to learn how to sing like Tony Martin, racing for the moon. You ought to hear these kids go. It's insane. It's really a make-it city. You guys who don't live in New York are not really aware of this. And kids from the age of 16 and 17 who live particularly in the New York, the Manhattan, Bronx, Brooklyn complex, they're real make kids. They're real make-out kids in many different ways. That's a fact. And so by the time they're 22, oh, believe me, oh, forget it. They're like, if we're all starting on a track, all of us together, oh, boy, and you're running against two New Yorkers, and there's nine of you guys from Indianapolis, forget it. When you see them, they're going around the corner. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, I'll talk about that later. Terrible hobby. Well... This is an intrigue. I don't think this has ever been pointed out. Almost every novel about the Army, for example, the hip novels, I'm talking about the Joseph Heller School and all that, the guys that really make the scene, has come out of the New Yorker type of person. You know, they're really hip. They go in there right away, they become captains, you know. Then they write the angry novel about war, you know. Very hip inside novels. Well, it just follows then, of course, that a guy like Ambrose Bierce was a Midwesterner, you know. It follows very clearly that a guy like Thurber was a Midwesterner. Private, you know, private. He got out of the Army after World War I. He didn't write the hip novel about war. He's a private, you know. You don't see much of it. You're a private. So you don't get hip enough to even know what goes on where the generals are. But that's not so with a New Yorker. So I arrived in the Army not knowing any of this. And it was a place you just got in. You didn't know that there were all deals. Listen, I know guys here in this town that have gotten, that embarrassed me when I heard about them. Guys within the last, a kid here at WOR, for example, comes up to me. He's going in the Army. Here about a year ago. And believe me, this guy knew more, and he was about 19 years old. This guy knew more strings. He knew more colonels, more majors, more lieutenant generals. Then and he comes to me for advice. T5 Shepherd, well, I could tell him how to make with the leggings, you know. I could tell him how to, you know, use the dubbing on the shoes and all that kind of stuff. But there's a funny thing about guys in the Midwest. They went into the Army, and the Army, there were generals, there were captains, there were colonels, and then there were the guys in the Army, and that's what you were. You know, you were in the Army. And it wasn't, most of us didn't wake up until far too late. That almost all those guys that were up there were guys who knew how to make the scene. You know, they hit the ground running, boy. And they were born. 5 minutes later, they're tearing for a cab. And this is just the way it is. You don't know this until you come out. It took me, in living in New York, it took me a year before I could get up the courage to hail a cab. I mean, a cab was for the official people. It's a fact that I was here 4 months before I got into a subway. My first 2 months, I walked. My third month, I got into the buses. You know, I realized that they let people in the buses. And then I heard about the subway, you know, and I bought a couple of those things, and I tried it out one day, and it worked pretty good. I was amazed. And it wasn't, as I said, it was about 2 years, and then finally one day, in a moment of desperation, I hailed a cab. I thought, well, they won't recognize me, you know. And I hailed a cab, figuring, you know, the officers get the cab. I waved the cab. The guy stopped. I got in. 5 minutes later, I'm riding along Park Avenue. I feel like I'm a colonel, you know, something like that. Hey, fellow, for crying out loud, I'm in a hurry. Will you get moving? And it took me years, though, to learn that. Well, the thing that this built up, of course, was a general feeling of being a genuine pawn. But you expected to be a pawn. You see, guys from the it doesn't surprise me that guys from the East Coast are continually writing angry novels about little people being pawns of a great mechanized society. Because they never consider themselves pawns. You know, they don't consider themselves a part of this fantastic thing. And they should be all colonels. You know, what is this? This is a pawn. I'm a pawn. It's a terrible, rotten civilization. Well, a guy from the Midwest generally, and it has to do with many things, religious backgrounds, I can go into with a million things, living in a city that is never, nobody originates a television show, but nobody in Indianapolis. Believe me, it does not happen. Very few of them even come from Chicago. So if you lived in a city, I don't know how you would feel if you lived in a city where all the things that you watch, all the things that you read are reports on other places. It's as though the place you live in doesn't even exist at all, and you begin to believe it, too. You believe that it has no genuine identity. It has no real meaning in the world. And so if you live in, say, Zanesville, Ohio, well, you know, Zanesville, Ohio. Well, Zanesville. So you accept the fact that you are a pawn by nature. You're a pawn. That's it. There's no other way to exist. You're a pawn. And you don't even know you're a pawn. You're just this person, you know, this little nothing in this fantastic world where either the shows come from New York or Hollywood. And there you are, you know. And you fool around, and that's it. So one day you find yourself in the Army, and you're in the Army. That's a, you know, you go in the Army, and you're still the same thing. So you walk around, and then you begin to wonder, well, how did these guys get this? And you see these guys with the things on their shoulders and all that, and you don't know how they got there. How did they know? You know, where did they make the scene? How did this all happen? And it takes you a couple of years to realize, you know, it's funny how kids never question their teachers, really. You know, the teacher's a teacher, and he's, you know, official. The woman teacher's official. And you don't ever go up to the teacher, hey, teacher, how long you study arithmetic? And find out they never studied it at all, you know? You're teaching me arithmetic. What is this? Well, that's the way with the Army. I found out, it was about a year I was in the Army, I found out that most of the guys who were my lieutenants had only been in like in 6 weeks. You know, and it began to dawn on me, what is this? You know, and I found out that they have the IQs of 48, you know. But one thing, they're sharp. They knew they when they went to that place, wherever it was you signed, shoop, they're in the right line. Guess what line Daddy was in? I was in the line that the guy stood up in the front of, the guy, the master sergeant, said, "Oh, you guys, get in the line over there." That isn't the right line. But that's the line I was in, always. I always wondered where how I would see other guys going into these other doors. They never seemed to stand in line. They were always going into doors, you know. They would bend over where they're taking the forms, you know, right. Oh, yeah, of course. The next thing I know, he's leaving the line. He's back going through a door. 10 minutes later, the guy's got things on his shoulders. All I got is holes in my arms from the shots. You know? Oh, yeah, yeah. It was a wild thing. So I arrived at this camp, and there was a camp in this area that was an absolute hotbed of it, and I didn't really understand it. Because, you see, up to this point, I'd been at a couple of camps where it was like the army, you know, all the army. Everybody was getting flayed. Get out there, tote that parlor, and sweating and raining on people and everything. Everybody was in trouble, you know, even the officers, everybody, just rotten. Well, suddenly I arrive at Fort Monmouth, and I did not realize that the army could be like this. Never let in an outsider. Absolutely. Once an outsider gets in, the whole thing starts to fall down. You know this. It's the truth. A club, you know how it is. So there would be a solid phalanx of these guys with the sharp pressed uniforms, and they all lived in town. In town means on the east side. New Yorky. Oh, boy. I never saw an army, an entire army that would commute to pads in the village. Well, you know, I never even heard about this before. You know, it was just a complete, and none of these, and all these guys had come from New York and had never been out of New York, which amazed me. And oh boy, it was everything you see. So these are very official people. Well, they had not only that, not only did they have that. Now every cook who was in the army there at that place at that time was from the Waldorf or from some fantastic place. I never ate in my life. Like one time, Jack looks at me, like one time I arrived at this camp. It was a funny thing in Monmouth here. And I was used to army food, you see. And by a fluke of nature, by a specific little thing that I had learned in the army, a little specialty, I was assigned briefly and very temporarily to this headquarters company. I will not describe. You could not believe the food these guys lived in. To begin with, they had, can you imagine this in the army? They had a pastry chef in this headquarters company who had been a pastry chef at a very famous hotel in New York. Very famous. This is a pastry chef. I don't mean a guy that made biscuits. So every morning, this guy had one job. He would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and he would bake Danish. He would bake Danish and pastry for breakfast for the headquarters company. Oh, it was unbelievable. And this guy would bake Danish and pies. And then, now you haven't heard the rest of it. They had a couple of chefs in the same company who had been meat chefs at the same hotel. So immediately when they came in, they were made master sergeants. You go, they work, you know, go, the colonel was. So it was the only time I've ever seen guys trying to stow away from all other companies in the area, trying to stow away in the mess line. And they used to watch you. It was like, really, I'm serious, it was like eating every day at the Sherry Netherland or at the Plaza. I'm not kidding you. I mean, that it was that quality food. Well, they really had it made, you know, all the way. And I couldn't believe it. Well, among other things, what had happened at this place, at this point? Now, I don't know what happened later. This was at this point during the fracas. What had also happened was that a lot of very famous people came there. They didn't want to leave New York. They were writers and things. These guys had they had radio shows going, you know, and they had all kinds of businesses that they were involved in. So, you know, it's very inconvenient to go to a war, you know, give up all that stuff. So these guys, wrangled themselves a deal to be at Fort Monmouth. So they would be in the army, and at the same time, they would be carrying on whatever it was, like, you know, selling their novels or writing the short stories or doing the articles for the magazine. It's all right, Ted, I'll do it when it comes to it. Don't worry about it. So these guys had you know, and I couldn't believe it. And another thing too about the solid phalanx was that they had worked out a system. You know about the army, Ted. They had worked out a system of nobody ever saying anything about anybody else. So if certain guys would be absent, say, like 3 or 4 days, nobody would say anything because the other guys had to be absent for 3 or 4 days because their play was opening. I'll tell you, it was an insane scene. It was wild. So I arrived there, you know, and here I am with about 19 other pure A1, 100% privates. And we arrived at this place, and we were assigned very, very briefly to this headquarters company, and it was like suddenly finding yourself in Wonderland. Literally, Wonderland. It was not at all like the Army. And all these guys, they didn't even have fatigues. And they all had tailored uniforms, and they all had cars, and for some reason or other, they seemed to have an unlimited supply of gas. This was during the war, you know. And they had late model automobiles. It was like they were all baby Moss hearts. And the entire New York scene was making it. These guys were making movies, the whole bit out there. Wow. And I thought, wowie, you know, and immediately my eyeballs start to shine, little realizing that I was in the outer darkness and never would make it. My Midwestern accent was against me. I didn't know the terrain. I mean, how could I talk about it? Really, now, seriously, you got to have the language to be in. How I didn't even know where 54th Street was in the air. You know how you guys are. You can, you know, Danny's Hideaway, never heard of. You know, what are you going to do about Danny's Highway? My idea of coming to New York was to get on the Greyhound and go, if you could possibly do it, was to go to the stage door canteen, get a sandwich, and then get a free ticket to a radio. And if possible, make it go to Radio City Music Hall and see the Rockettes. That was my idea. Oh, wow, I didn't know. You know, whew, think of what I could have done. Well, anyway, I want to tell you this wild thing that happened one day. I'm very innocent, see. And I had come from this Midwestern place, you know. I'd been in the Army, and a lot of guys would be flubbing around. We played softball and things like that when we were taking PT. And so I got no pass at all. And about 5 other guys with me, no pass. We had no passes. They weren't going to let us out. So we're fooling around, and there was a notice on the bulletin board that said, "This coming Sunday, the New York Giants are going to be at the field where PT and the parades go on. They're going to be at the great big parade ground at the Ball Diamond on the north end, and they are going to play the post team." Well, I mean, you know, this is better than going down to the service club and playing ping pong. And, you know, and to me, the New York Giants are coming down. You know, to me, the Giants, when you live out in the Midwest, you hear about the Giants and you hear about the Yankees. Honestly, I can't describe it. It's like hearing about Babylon or something. You know, it's just something. They come out of the East, the storied East. They club the Cubs into submission and leave. And, you know, nobody ever thinks about anything. They're not big, you know, just big. So I'm going to see the Giants, Ed. Little did I realize that I was going to meet something that I had never couldn't possibly have comprehended living in the Midwest, where the closest you ever got to a major league ball player was like the second deck in Section 28, where once in a while you could holler out, "Hey, Luke! Hey, Luke! Hey, Luke!" That's about as close as I ever got to a ball player. Well, today I am standing on the field and the buses pulled up. I am there early because I figure, you know, there's going to be a crowd of guys show up for this scene. Little did I realize how sophisticated and blasé Fort Monmouth was. So I'm waiting. I figure, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning is not too early for a 2 o'clock game, because I knew that if you were, I better do this. Ted's getting the itch. We've got the Mandarin House here. So we have the Mandarin House. And, hey, one thing I want to make the point very clear about. About 9 of you people have been going to the wrong restaurant up and writing me. Yeah, I mean, this is terrible. There are about 19 restaurants up in that area, up along Broadway, between 102nd and 103rd, that have the wrong name. These names all sound alike. Be very careful. Between 103rd and 102nd, there is a place called, are you ready? The Great Shanghai. Now, this is also operated by Emily Kuo and is a superb Cantonese Shanghai-style restaurant. And if you dig Shanghai-type food, which is a very special kind of food, I would suggest you try this one. Between 102nd and 103rd on Broadway. Got it? The Great Shanghai. Don't go to the wrong place now. And they get very mad because it didn't turn out the way I said it would. There are about 20 of them around up there, and it's the Great Shanghai. Got it? Okay. Well, Now, you want to hear old Shep standing on the field there at Monmouth? Let me describe the scene. It is Sunday morning, and there is something very milky and hopeless about Sunday mornings in the Army. If you know how, you know that funny feeling you get at home on Sundays, that feeling of kind of, oh, you know, and the papers are there, and people fool around, and they turn on the television set, and somebody says, let's go for a walk, and all that jazz, you know. And, well, in the Army, there is another element added to it. And it's the element that there is no walk you can go to. It's the element that it isn't even going to start to happen on Monday. See, that's the interesting thing about being a civilian. You always plan for Wednesday, secretly in your mind, that one day a great thing is going to happen to you. Well, in the Army, it's quite the reverse. You plan for a terrible thing that's going to happen to you. Someday, it's going to happen. The worst possible thing, especially when you're in the war. I mean, you don't think in terms of great things happening to you. You think in terms of, well, now, let's see, if I get it in the shoulder, oh, yeah, that's the way guys figure. Yeah, that's a very interesting difference. So anyway, it's Sunday. You got the scene? And it's a kind of a cloudy Sunday, and I am there at 9 o'clock in the morning, waiting anxiously for the buses and all that to arrive, and I figure, you know, it's going to be a real fight to get into those stands. And there I am, and there's about three other guys, all from the Midwest, louts like me. And we're waiting. It's 9 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, getting up on Sunday, that's the only time you can sleep in the Army. And getting up at 9 o'clock, you know, you had to get up at 8 o'clock, get your thing. And nobody fools around the Army. You don't walk around in your T-shirt, you know. You got to get up, you shave, you got to put on a shirt, you know, all this pajazz, you know. So there I'm all dressed up in my little suitie, and I'm down there waiting and very anxious to see what's going to happen. The New York Giants are coming. Well, we wait. And another guy joins us from Minnesota or someplace. And we wait. It is now 11 o'clock, and we're sitting in the wooden stands. They have little wooden stands, little tiny ones, you know, like they have at Little League games. A little wooden stand, see? And it's now 10 o'clock, and finally it's 10:30, and next it's 11 o'clock, and it's 11:30, and it goes on and on and on. And then I see pulling up back around the rear where they have the long sheds where they keep tractors and stuff. I see this big gray bus pull up. It's an Army bus. It's a U.S. Army. Pulls up there. We look, and sure enough, a lot of guys get out, a whole bunch of guys. He said, wow, you know, whoo, and we're watching, and about 30 guys get out of the bus, and we're looking out, you know, we're all excited, so, geez, and sure enough, they begin to drift over one by one, and they're looking around, they're fooling, and then they get back in the bus, and they go away. Yeah, we're very excited now. That was them, the New York Giants, because they were in civilian clothes, see, it's the Giants, whoo, and we're waiting very excitedly. Now it is noon. It's getting a little warm, you see. It's now 12:30. Somebody runs down to the PX and gets us a bunch of Milky Way bars, and we're holding a seat. There's nobody else has arrived yet. You see, it's all four of us. We're holding the seats there. See? Don't. Now, if they start coming, you're home. I'm sitting here, you see. I don't care if it is a master sergeant. Hit them. I'm sitting. I've been here since tomorrow. Here, I'll leave my cap. No, better not leave. I'll leave my shoe here. There, my shoe. That was that kind of a scene. We're waiting excitedly. Well, to make a long story even more dismal, roughly about 1 o'clock, there are now about 25 guys in the stands, a scattering of guys. And sure enough, the bus arrives back. Apparently they have taken them somewhere where the officers eat and have fed these guys or something. And now they get out of the bus, Eddie, and they are wearing baseball suits. Yep, they have dressed, and they got real base. And they're the Giants. It's the Giants. They got the white uniforms, you know, with the blue hats. And why other? It's the Giants. And there's 20 of us, you know, all from the Midwest. And these guys come running out on the field, you know, they're throwing around, they're fooling around. And of course, we're looking. We don't know what to say, you know. Wow. And there's a first baseman where I'm sitting on the first baseline. There's a guy about 9 feet away from me. He's the first baseman of the Giants. And they're tossing the ball back and forth. These guys whipping it around. And you know, we don't know who the post team is. You say, who's the post team? You know, we never heard about a post team. You know, the post team. And about 10 minutes later, a big Army bus arrived. And you should have seen it. A bunch of guys get out who were at least 12 and a half feet tall. Out of our... And they got suits on. And it says on the front of them, Monmouth. These guys are monsters. And they get out, you know. And what happens? We can't believe it. They're walking out on the field, you know, and they all know each other. Hey, Phil, for crying out loud. Hey, Phil, oh, oh. And they're hitting each other and shaking and yelling. And I can't, what kind of, a, you know, who are these guys? These guys who are supposed to be us. They're representing us. And they know the first baseman is a guy named Phil Weintraub. Any of you ever hear of Phil Weintraub? He was right in front of me. He was playing first base for the wartime Giants, I will tell you. Weintraub is hitting this guy in the back, and they're yelling at each other. And Bill Jurgis is playing shortstop for the wartime Giants. Famous shortstop. And he's yelling and hollering at all these soldiers. I thought, for crying out loud, what is this? Wow. And by this time, the fans, you know, begin to show up. And about 10 minutes before game time, there's about 100 guys, 20 of which are from Midwest, all sitting awed. And the other 60 guys are hippies from New York who know every one of these guys. Hey, Phil! Oh, for crying out loud! Manny! Oh, and they're hitting each other. They're all friends, you know. I don't know what is it. And I'm watching the big league ball game. Well, to make the long story even sadder, the first inning goes this way. The New York Giant pitcher is out there. Little did I realize I was watching wartime baseball. He winds up, and the first one of the Fort Monmouth soldiers belts a ball about 590 feet. Pow! And he tears around second, tears into third, comes across that home plate without even breathing hard. Little did I realize that almost every one of the Giants, the real New York Giants, were at Monmouth. And our pitcher was a man named Darius Musso. Did you ever hear of Musso, who pitched with the Yankees, belts balls for miles? It was an in-group and an in-group and an in-group and an in-group. There will be a...
This is WOR Radio, your station for news.